welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on 29 AM and FM radio stations 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on profiling, right after this. You know, we Americans talk a lot about private business. We use terms like private ownership, private property, private rights. But we also use terms like stocks, bonds, negotiable instruments, licenses, and permits in our pursuit of profit and gain in our business transactions. Well, listen to this. Did you know that stocks and negotiable instruments are the exact opposite to private ownership? Bonds are the exact opposite to private property. Public business licenses are the exact opposite to private rights, and permits are the exact opposite to private business. And why is it that we see small business being subjected to such a constant barrage of attacks by government at every level from Washington to your hometown? And what can you do to protect your life, your liberty, and your property from these incessant attacks by government agencies like OSHA, the EPA, the State Tax Commission, Zoning and Planning, the IRS, and the swarms of government agents and agencies that are eating out your substance? Well, you know, there's a lot that you can do. The first step is to inform yourself as to the legal alternatives that you have between public business and private business. To learn more about private business, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package, and let me tell you more about what it is that you're not supposed to know about private business. It's educational, it's entertaining, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. You can call and order yours right now, the number 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. If you're online, just go to the website georgegordon.org. Click onto the email and send an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. Profiling. It's a no-no in America today. If you were profiled, you'd complain. You'd say, my God, they're selecting me because I'm a Catholic, or they're picking me out of the line because I'm black or white or green or red, or I've got red hair and blue eyes or some combination thereof. I'm not quite sure why profiling is so, what should we say, bad, terrible, wicked, awful? What's wrong with it? If the police got a call in that said, a white male, 6 foot tall, robbed a bank, well, wouldn't that be a great help in eliminating all of the Mexicans, blacks, and Orientals? You know, we could just eliminate three whole groups of people there, and we're looking for a white male. Are we looking for just any white male? No, we're looking for one that's 6 foot tall. So all the short white males we can leave out. It eliminates all the females. We're not looking for a woman. It kind of narrows it down like 20 questions. Remember that old radio program called 20 Questions, and they just tell you, well, I'm thinking of something. It's animal, vegetable, or mineral. That's all they tell you. It's either animal, it's vegetable, or mineral. You could ask 20 questions to guess what it was. And you know, almost every time they would guess what it was. I mean, you could pick out something like a Mercedes automobile, and all they tell you is it's animal, vegetable, or mineral, and you had to ask the right questions in order to get it down to an automobile, and a Mercedes automobile at that. I guess that's profiling, isn't it? Well, listen to this. In 1997, government attorneys worried that a proposed anti-terrorism system for airlines might work too well. Although an early prototype of the computer-assisted passenger pre-screening system, called CAPS-1, assiduously avoided collecting information about a passenger's national origin, religion, race, or sex, is assessing the risk that he might be a terrorist, civil rights lawyers in the Justice and Transportation Departments fretted that the system might still be discriminatory, and it still might pull aside too many people of Arab descent by looking at, say, frequent travel to the Middle East, among other risk factors. Well, given the previous two decades of Islamic terrorism, such an outcome would have been appropriate. But the rights enforcers wanted and warned that airlines could face penalties if they selected more than three passengers of the same ethnicity for additional scrutiny on any given flight. So the prototype architects built random hits into their program to ensure that airline screeners would devote as much time searching Lutheran matrons from Minnesota as young men from Saudi Arabia. God, I can hardly contain myself. Can you believe that crap? Let me ask you a question. When was the last time that some old woman from Minnesota strapped on explosives and blew herself up on a bus? Can you tell me that? As far as I can tell, the only people that are doing that in the world are men, once in a while a woman. They're all Middle Eastern, and they're all Muslims. Now, doesn't that send you a message? You know, they look back at World War II and they say, oh my God, look what they did to the Japanese. I think there was 120 or 150,000 Japanese. Now, you could profile all of these Japs. That was easy enough to do. Say, wait a minute. Here's what they did. They attacked us at Pearl Harbor. We got 120,000 of them here in the United States. Let's round them all up, put them in concentration camps until the war's over. Then, after the war, everybody got kind of repentant about that and said, well, the Japanese weren't nearly as big a problem as we thought they were going to be, and so now we feel real bad. It made all the sense in the world in 1942 to round them up. Now, of course, you got 7 million Muslims in the United States, so rounding up 7 million and putting them in internment camps, I don't think that there's enough resources to do that. But it sends you another message, doesn't it, in our pluralistic society? You know, when God gave us this piece of real estate and he told us, you know, not to make marriages with these foreigners and aliens around us, you think he was whistling Dixie through a straw hat? If you take a look at all of the race hatred and biases that go on around the world, you'll find that in Sweden, they don't have any racial problems. They don't have any mixed races in their country. But every place that you go in the world where you have mixed people together, religiously, ethnically, racially, you got problems. Take a look at the Sudan. You got Arabs in the north and you got blacks in the south, and they hate each other. They've been fighting with each other for years. And the only reason that Sudan is called a country is because of colonialism. The British, when they colonized the Sudan, put all this together and ruled it all. Then when they gave them their independence back in the 1950s, you've got these racially different people. You got Muslims in the north and animists in the south and Christians and all these people. And they hate each other, and you got nothing but race war, unrestricted race war. Look at it. Pay attention. Take a look at what's going on in Britain. You know, 50 or 100 years ago, you didn't have a problem with race in Great Britain until you started bringing all these people from around the world to England. Now take a look at what you got. Now, over in Europe, you got the same thing. You know, they needed labor, so they went out to the Muslim countries of North Africa and Turkey and so on and brought them in. Now look at the problems you get. See, those people are good people, and I'm not running Muslims down. I'm just telling you, when God separated the races of people back in Genesis chapter 10, he knew what he was doing, and he knew why he was doing it. And he had a pretty good reason. And that is, people that have different religions, different ethnicities, different nationalities, don't get along well together. So if you give Turkey to the Turks, and you give Saudi Arabia to the Arabians, and you give Africa to the blacks, and you give China to the Chinese, and so on, and then get the hell out of their lives and leave them alone, you'll have a lot less problems. Back in the 1850s, Admiral Perry sailed into Tokyo Bay and said, now you people want to trade with us, now don't you? And if you don't, look what we're going to do to you. It's the white man that's been the biggest problem around the world, bringing these people together, the British bringing these people together in the Sudan, who are now fighting each other and killing each other by the tens of thousands. But if you try to profile people, if you say, well, look, they're Oriental here in the United States, you know, oh, we're going out and we're looking for a guy. It's all right if you say he's got black hair, blonde hair, or red hair. But if you say he's Oriental, that's racial profiling. We can't have that. If you say, hey, this guy is a black Afro-American, my God, that's racial profiling. And I'm sitting here asking you the question, what in the hell's wrong with racial profiling? I'm a white, old male. Shouldn't you say, you're looking for an old white male with gray hair and a gray beard. That's what you're looking for. See, that way you can eliminate, you know, looking for Orientals and blacks and all these other, you can avoid looking for young people and you can avoid looking for women. Couldn't you? I think we've taken this racial profiling to the absurd. It's now gotten to where it's insane. Listen, there's more to the story. Public policy obsession with avoiding any possible charge of racism was the luxury of an age that believed that the United States faced no greater danger than the bigotry of its own people. Though such thinking should have been cast aside after 9/11, it hasn't. The incoherence that existed at the origin of CAPS 1 plagues the anti-terrorism efforts of today. In 1997, the government recognized the reality of Islamic terrorism by building some Islamic-centric features into the program, while simultaneously repudiating the consequences of that reality, stricter scrutiny for Muslims. Currently, from immigration enforcement to intelligence gathering, government officials continue to compromise national security in order to avoid accusations of racial profiling and in order to avoid publicly acknowledging that the 9/11 Commission finally said that the enemy is not just terrorism, but Islamic terrorists. Now, this blind anti-discrimination reflex is all the more worrying since radical Islam continues to seek adherence and plan attacks in and against the United States. The anti-discrimination hammer has hit the airline industry most severely and with gruesome inappropriateness, given the realities of 9/11 and the Islamists' enduring obsession with airplanes. Department of Transportation lawyers have extracted millions in settlements from four major carriers for alleged discrimination after 9/11, and they have undermined one of the most crucial elements of air safety, a pilot's responsibility for his flight. Because the charges against the airlines were specious, but successful. Every pilot must worry that his good faith effort to protect his passengers will trigger federal retaliation. Well, let me pause here for a moment and ask, is the federal government working to protect us, or are they working to kill us? Now, tuck that one away in your hearts. Over in Israel, they arm the cockpit crews. In America, we don't. You get on an LL airliner, and the pilot's packing heat. You get on an American airliner, and the pilot's got nothing but a door between him and the terrorist, or alleged terrorist. And furthermore, every one of these terrorist attacks is being carried out by a Muslim, a Middle Eastern young male. That's the guy who is creating all of the chaos. Helen Chenoweth, a former representative from Idaho, was getting on an airplane up in Boise, and they announced to her that they were going to search her. She said, "Not by the hair on my chinny chin chin are you going to search me." She called here the other day and she said, "Well, I guess I'm a foot like you are, because I didn't get on the airline." They said, "If you don't get searched, you ain't getting on the plane." Now, when was the last time that an ex-congressional representative strapped on plastic explosives and ball bearings and got on an airliner and blew it up? I tell you, boys and girls, our government is not here to protect us from the Muslim extremists who are the problem. Old ladies from Minneapolis are not the problem, and old men from Isabella, Missouri aren't the problem. Over in Russia, they had two women get on two airliners and blow them up. Weren't they both Muslim? You know, my common sense would tell me that if you wanted to search somebody getting on an airplane, you want to search the Muslims, don't you? When was the last time you heard of a Buddhist, a Shintoist, or a Christian strapping on explosives and blowing up an airplane? My God, you know, have we taken leave of our senses? Is there no reason, logic, or common sense left in the country? You know, if I was running that show, I would search every Muslim, every Middle Eastern descendant person that wanted to get on an airplane or move. I'd search them all. Well, if I could. Now, this policy isn't coming from the Muslims. This policy is coming from our government. You know, the government that taxes us and then tells us that they're trying to protect us. That's why I don't get on airplanes. The other day, somebody sent me a hell of a neat deal. It was an advertisement, and it said, we want you to come down here to Orlando, Florida. And I don't know, it was $199, and you can get on a Carnival cruise, and you can go out here and sail around in the Caribbean, and we'll fly you down here and fly you back, and one thing and another. I told the wife, I said, write him a letter, explain to him, I've got the money for the trip, I would like to make the trip, but I can't. And I can't make the trip because I'd have to give up my Fourth and Fifth Amendment constitutionally protected rights to get on a damn airplane. As far as I can tell, white Christian American males and females and old men and old ladies, you know, running around America, Americans haven't been causing any problems. It's Muslim, Middle Eastern males. They're causing the problem. They're the ones that need to be searched. But wait a minute. According to the guidelines, you can't search the Muslims. See, that would be profiling. You can't search these Middle Eastern males. That's profiling. So what we're going to do, we're going to protect all the people of America. And what we're going to do is we're going to search the white, the Orientals. Orientals aren't blowing themselves up. Orientals aren't out here killing people. The whites aren't out here killing people. But we're going to search them. At least in World War II, it was the Japs that were bombing Pearl Harbor. It was the Japs who declared war on the United States. And so our government very wisely rounded up all the Japs, locked them up, and said, well, until this is over, until we get this settled, we don't know whose side you guys are on. Now, it's true. Not every Muslim is over here blowing himself up. Did you see what just happened over in Mosul? I was watching the news tonight. And in that mess tent where 22 Americans were killed, an Iraqi working on the base, strapped on the explosives, walked in. And, of course, he had a right to be there. He passed through. He was working there on the base and blew himself up and 20 others. Well, now that sends you a signal, isn't it? When was the last time you heard of an American soldier strapping on explosives and walking in, blowing himself up? I'll bet you they're going to be searching the American soldiers and everybody else. Those aren't the problems. You know where the problem is. And I don't know who comes up with these ideas, but the head of the Transportation Department here in the United States is a Jap. You know, this guy's name is Mineta. Let's take a look at him. And I think he's still suffering from World War II. Now, you know, if old white male Americans were blowing up airplanes, and I could see walking into an airport and some guy hauling me off to the side and saying, hey, look, we're looking for old white men with gray beards and thinning hair. Well, I'd say, well, I guess I'm the guy you want to be searching, and I'm the guy you want to be looking for. I tell you, boys and girls, when history is written 100 years or 200 years from now, people are going to look at this and say, my God, these Americans just plumb went insane. They just went crazy. Nuts. It gets worse. On its face, the government's charge that American was engaged in a pattern of discriminatory conduct was absurd, given how few passenger removals occurred. But the racism allegation looks all the more unreasonable when put in the context of the government's own actions. Three times between 9/11 and the end of 2001, public officials warned of an imminent terror attack. Transportation officials urged the airlines to be especially vigilant. In such an environment, pilots would have been derelict not to resolve security questions in favor of caution. Somehow, Department of Transportation lawyers failed to include in their complaint one further passenger whom American Airlines asked not to board in 2001. On December 22nd, airline personnel in Paris kept Richard Reed off of a flight to Miami. The next day, French authorities insisted that he be cleared to board. During the flight, Reed tried to set off a bomb in his shoe, but a stewardess and passenger spoiled him. Had he been kept from flying on both days, he too might have ended up on the government's roster of discrimination victims. I want to point out that this guy, Richard Reed, now, was an Englishman, Muslim. Now, you know, Muslims, there's a billion of them around the world, and I would imagine that about 99% of them are pretty peaceable people. But it's that 1% that aren't. Now, you know, Christians aren't too far behind those Muslims in their terrorist activities. Just take a look at Christians killing people during the Middle Ages. We called them Catholics, and they're out here busily butchering Protestants. Take a look at North Ireland. I mean, you got these Irish Catholics and these Irish Protestants, same group of people, all Irishmen, killing each other over religion. So it isn't something that just popped up last week, and it's a Muslim problem. It just happens that right now, it's the Muslims that are the problem. It is the Middle Eastern male Muslims. But it gets worse. Listen to this. Jihad is J-E-H-A-D. Al-Sharifi is typical of those who were included in the suit against American. On November the 3rd, 2001, the Jordanian-American Al-Sharifi was scheduled to fly out of Boston's Logan Airport, from which two of the hijacked planes, including American 77, departed on 9/11. Well, a federal air marshal told the pilot that Al-Sharifi's name resembled one on a terror watch list, and that it had been acting suspiciously, had created a disturbance at the gate, and posed unresolved security issues. The pilot denied him boarding. Al-Sharifi was later cleared and given first-class passage on another flight. According to the Department of Transportation, the only reason that American initially denied Al-Sharifi passage was because of his race, color, national origin, religion, sex, or ancestry. Never mind that there were at least five other passengers of Arab descent on this or on his original flight, none of whom had been given additional screening or kept from flying. In fact, on virtually every flight on which the government claims that American Airlines acted out of racial animus, other passengers of apparent Middle Eastern or South Asian ancestry flew undisturbed, not to mention the undoubted thousands of Arab passengers who flew with American on other flights in the final months of 2001. If the Department of Transportation believes that an air marshal's warnings about a passenger's name and suspicious behavior are insufficient grounds for keeping him off of a flight, it's hard to imagine circumstances that would justify a security hold in the department's view, short of someone's declaring his intention to blow up a plane. Now, given the information presented to the pilot, the only conceivable reason to have allowed Al-Sharifi to board would have been fear of a lawsuit. And litigation phobia is precisely the mindset that the Department of Transportation is hoping to cultivate in flight personnel. 10 days after 9/11, the department started rolling out guidance documents on non-discrimination. While heavy on platitudes about protecting civil rights, they are totally useless in advising airlines as to how to avoid the government's wrath. The closest the department gets to providing airlines a concrete rule for avoiding litigation is a but-for test. Ask yourself, advise the guidelines, but for this person's perceived race, ethnic heritage, or religious orientation, would I have subjected this individual to additional safety or security scrutiny? If the answer is no, then the action may violate civil rights laws. There isn't a week that goes by that I don't get a letter, an email, or somebody who's writing me some horror story, like Helen Chenoweth, telling me about being selected, being zeroed in on. Why in the world would you zero in on somebody who's a white Anglo-Saxon, an old woman, and then want to pull her out for additional screening? Can you tell me that? It's beyond me. It just boggles your mind. If there was somebody you wanted to pull out for additional screening, wouldn't it be a Middle Eastern male? Well, aren't you looking for an Arab? Oh, God, I don't know. But security decisions are never that clear. A safety officer will consider many factors in calculating someone's riskiness. Someone's riskiness. Can you tell me how many Christians, how many whites, how many German immigrants, how many German tourists have blown up airplanes or blown themselves up on a bus? You know, in every single case, you've got Muslims. Every single case, you've got Middle Eastern males, except for two exceptions. Two females blew up two Russian airplanes. Hey, now, that tells me that most of the time you're looking for males. Some of the time you're looking for females. And they're sitting there saying, well, we got to make it look like it's even-handed because we don't want racial profiling. I say nuts to that. We want racial profiling. You want to identify the people that are causing the problem, don't you? I mean, let's be intelligent people. You know, when a crime is committed and the 7-Eleven or the Circle K clerk calls the police and says, I've just been robbed. And the police want to know, well, what did this guy look like? And they say, well, he was a black Afro-American, about 5'7". Well, then that eliminates all the whites, doesn't it? What if the police said, no, stop. Don't tell us what his race was. We don't want to know that. We just want a physical description, but we don't want to know if he's Asian, white, black, male or female, and we don't want to know his religion either. come on. Surely we got to be smarter than that, boys and girls. Honest to God, can you believe what you're hearing here? In fact, about half the complaints in the government's action were not even Middle Eastern. Many were Hispanic. One was a Norwegian. One was a Sicilian. The Department of Transportation simply assumes without evidence that American scrutinized the men because of the mistaken belief that they were Arabs rather than because of their behavior. A pilot trying to apply the but-for test to his own security judgment will inevitably reduce the test to an easier calculus. Deny passage to someone who is or could claim to look Muslim only under the most extreme circumstances. In application, the government's but-for test reduces to a never-ever rule. Ethnic heritage, religion, or national origin may play no role in evaluating risk. Can you believe that insanity? Listen to that again. In application, this is the way we're going to put it into practice. The government's but-for test reduces to a never-ever rule. Don't you ever look at ethnic heritage, religion, or national origin, because that can play absolutely no role in evaluating the risk. Well, I don't know. We haven't had any problems with Hispanics. We haven't had any problems with Norwegians, have we? And yet they're sitting there saying, well, we're going to zero in on these Norwegians. We're going to have a random test. And it gets better. See, as time goes on, in this article, there are some cases where they've got Middle Eastern Arabs walk right on through. We don't even give them a second glance. And then we pick out this old German lady over here, and we scrutinize her, and we want to look up her butt to see whether or not she's carrying explosives up her rectum. Can you believe that? I'm not kidding you. Oh, God. The opinions, beliefs, and comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and they're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of the network or of this radio station. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to my website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call the law school direct, 417-273-4967. You know, old Joe Smith started out the day early. He set his alarm clock made in Japan for 6 a.m. while his coffee pot, which was made in Japan, is perking and puts his blow dryer made in Taiwan to work and shaves with his electric razor made in Hong Kong. He puts on a dress shirt made in Taiwan, his designer jeans made in Singapore, and a pair of tennis shoes made in Korea. After cooking up some breakfast in his new electric skillet, which is made in the Philippines, he sits down to figure out on his calculator, which was made in Mexico, how much money he can spend today. Then he sets his watch, made in Switzerland, to the radio, made in Hong Kong. Then he goes out and gets in his car, which is made in Germany, goes looking, as he has for many months, for a good-paying American job. Then at the end of another discouraging and fruitless day, Joe decides to relax for a while, so he puts on a pair of sandals, made in Brazil, pours himself a glass of wine, made in France, and then turns on his TV, made in Japan, and wonders again why it is that he can't find a good-paying American job. Well, instead of a good-paying American job, why doesn't Joe look for a good-paying American private business dealing in property instead of income? I know that's a wild new concept, property instead of income. But if you'd like to tap into this power of the private business, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package? That's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. Remember, it's informative, it's entertaining, it's free, it's educational. You can call right now. The number's 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to the website. That's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email machine, and then send me an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. Or call 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about this thing of racial profiling. One of the reasons that I won't fly anymore. Now, I used to fly quite a bit. Flew all over the United States, put on seminars and speeches and schools and one thing and another. That's a neat way to travel. You get on an airplane in Boise, Idaho, and you can get off in Detroit the same day. There was a time when I used to complain about identification. I went out to Frontier Airlines to get on a flight one time, this was many years ago, and a woman wanted identification. I said, what do you want identification for? And she said, well, we need your identification because the customer that sent the ticket. See, I had a customer in Kansas City, and he had sent a ticket. And when I went out to the airport to pick up the ticket, she wouldn't give it to me without identification. I said, well, how many George Gordons have been in here today trying to pick up that ticket? And she says, well, none that I know of. I said, well, here's your first one. I'm George Gordon. I don't have any identification. I don't have a social security number. I don't have a driver's license. I don't have any national ID card. I don't have any government identification. I don't do business with the government. The United States government, the Canadian government, German government. I don't do business with governments. Of course, I don't do business with the mafia or other criminal elements either. And she said to me, well, without identification, I'm not going to give you the ticket. And so, sure enough, at 4:30, the airplane took off, and without George Gordon on it. So I called my customer in Kansas City, and I told him what had just happened. And so I said, what we'll do is you get a refund on your tickets, and I'll just go over here and buy a ticket on United Airlines. So I went over to United, and I said, can I buy a ticket from you without any identification whatsoever? I just want to walk up and buy a ticket from you. And she said, well, certainly. So I just whipped out the money and stuck it on the counter. Can you imagine what would happen today if you whipped out $500 and bought a ticket? I mean, here you are, a white male with cash in your pocket, and you just whipped it out, plunked it on the counter and said, give me a ticket so I can go to Kansas City. Well, you know, today the government want to know, well, where in the world did you get all that cash? You must be a drug dealer. Why, you must be a criminal or something. Have you filed your income tax? Why, the very idea. See, these airline ticket girls, you know, they're government snitches. And when you walk up to the airline counter and whip out cash and put it down, they get a percentage of that. If you're a drug dealer or if you're a tax evader, any kind of crime they can catch you for, she's going to get 10% of that. And so they just turn everybody in, anybody that pays cash. That's another reason why I won't fly on the airlines. The government has hired all their ticket agents to be snitches for them. You want to run around and do business with a bunch of government snitches? I don't. So that's why I don't fly anymore. That's one reason. But see, there was a time in America when you could act freely. I mean, you could get on an airplane, you could get on a train, you could get on a bus. It didn't make any difference what your name, address, and telephone number was. You didn't have to have identification. You didn't have to have a driver's license or registration or anything else. You just buy a ticket and go somewhere. So that's the problem that I'm having with the Carnival cruise. That's the problem that I'm having spending money on travel. So all of you hotel workers and you airline people and you others out there that work in the vacation or the Walt Disney World and Carnival cruises and so on. That's why you're not getting any of my money. Now, I've got money to spend, and I'm going to go spend it on something, but I'm not going to spend it on vacations and cruises as long as you're telling me to bend over so you can look up my rectum. I'm not going to go through that. I'm not going to have some guy searching me. Now, if you want to search my baggage, that's fine. You know, no complaint about that. And if you need to search me, you got to take me off here on the side with the boys. I don't want to be searched now by some woman who's reaching up my thighs, up to my crotch. You know, I don't want that. And that's what Helen Chenoweth's complaint was. She said, I don't want some man over here groping all over me. I mean, for crying out loud, boys and girls, you airlines out there ought to start getting your head screwed on straight and start asking some hard questions. I'm sure I'm not the only guy in the country that's refusing to fly or travel, refusing to spend his money because of these insane government policies. Not the airlines. That's the problem, as far as I can tell. It's the Department of Transportation. It's the government that's creating this problem. Gets worse. Years of government lawsuits over specious employment discrimination claims have made the airlines gun-shy over bias issues. But American Airlines did contest the Department of Transportation's discrimination action because so much was at stake. Federal law vests final responsibility for flight safety with the pilot. For a passel of discrimination lawyers, months after the fact, the question of pilot's good faith judgment at the time, made with complete information or incomplete information, for that matter, under great time pressure, violates a crucial principle of secure aviation. Americans' defense pointed out that the behavioral warning signs that had led to the 11 removals, but fighting the government's civil rights complex is futile. In February of 2004, the airline, while vehemently denying guilt, settled the action for $1.5 million to be spent on yet more sensitivity training for its employees. Americans' pilots were outraged. Pilots felt, how dare they second-guess our decision, says Dennis Breslin, a pilots union official. We just shake our heads in shame. How could the government be so wrong? Hey, listen, it gets worse than that. When the airline pilots went to the Department of Transportation, says, hey, listen, give us guns so that we can defend our airplanes. They said, oh, my God, no, we can't have that. Not in America. Well, what's wrong with the pilots being armed? Listen, most of the pilots that are flying our commercial airliners were ex-Navy pilots or Air Force pilots. Those guys are all trained killers. They all carry a .45 under their armpit when they get in the cockpit of their airplane in case they have to bail out. They're armed. They're trained. They know how to use those guns. And even when the Airline Pilots Association said, well, look, we'll take these guys out and we'll train them, you know, run through a training course so they know how to use those guns, the Department of Transportation nixed the idea. America's pilots, the first line of defense in hijacking, should be armed up in the cockpit. Hell, I'd feel a lot better if you had 150 passengers on the airplane and every damn one of them had a gun. Do you believe for a minute, think about this now, in honest to God, do you believe that four armed, let's just imagine that everybody on the airplane, including the hijackers, all have guns. But on the airliner, you got another 100 people and they've all got guns. Do you think four hijackers would be enough to hijack an airplane with 100 armed passengers on the plane? Do you think four hijackers, all armed with 45s, could hijack an airplane if the three cockpit crew also had three guns in the cockpit? Do you believe that? That's why the Jews all arm their LL pilots. And they haven't had a single hijacking. Not one. None. Zero. By God, that must work, because they're flying their airplanes in and out of Israel day in and day out. And those, you know, those Palestinians, if they could shoot one down, if they could hijack one, they'd sure as hell do it now, wouldn't they? Yeah, I'd feel a lot safer and a whole lot more confident about getting on an airplane if I knew that the pilot was packing heat. Hell, I wouldn't even mind if the stewardesses were packing the guns, for crying out loud. Of course, you always got to worry about some guy grabbing the stewardess and taking the gun away from her. That's why I've always said, you know, that the Old West used to have a pretty good system. Most of the people, you know, 100 years ago, 150 years ago, were all packing guns out here on the frontier anyway. And that's kind of an equalizer. And down in Dallas, or not Dallas, it was Dade County, Florida, some years back, they trained 9,000 women down there in the use of handguns. And when they did that and advertised it, the rape rate went from one a day to one a month. That's a pretty significant drop in crime. I've always said, you know, every woman in America should be packing heat. It would sure as hell eliminate the rape problem, though, wouldn't it? Of course, it'd probably kill a few amorous boyfriends, but then, you know, that's the price you pay for checking crime, isn't it? Well, not satisfied with just one scalp, the Department of Transportation lawyers brought identical suits against United, Delta, and Continental Airlines. While maintaining their innocence, those carriers also settled, pledging more millions for sensitivity training. Money much better spent on security training than on indoctrinating pilots to distrust their own security judgments. A former security officer for United Airlines describes the chilling effect that bias investigations have on a pilot's safety decisions. So let's say that the government has just raised the terror alert level. Just before takeoff, a flight attendant tells the pilot, "I'm scared of these five guys in the back. They're talking intensely, but they get quiet when I pass." The pilot responds, "Tell me more. I saw them before boarding and they pretended not to know one another." The pilot observes them and sees the same thing. He decides to take them off that flight for a further security check. Well, the Transportation Department lawyers soon contact the flight manager about a discrimination complaint. The manager interviews the pilot and asks him to write a report. The pilot comes back to work, but week after week, he hears nothing about the investigation. The Department of Transportation's in no hurry. The pilot's anxiety level goes through the roof. Maybe he'll be sued or fired. Well, the next time a security question arises, will he make the same decision? Wonders the ex-United official. Well, not if the DOT can help it. You see, the Department of Transportation is hoping that he changes his behavior and looks for the positive. These guys are nicely dressed. I probably intimidate them. Heck, maybe they're talking about women. Well, in addition to individual discrimination suits, the government has continued to disparate impact analysis on anti-terror measures. One of the most destructive innovations of the rights lobby. Such analysis, which assigns bigotry to neutral policies if they affect different demographic groups differently, is suicidal in a war-fighting situation. It rules out every security procedure that might actually be useful in combating Muslim terrorists, since a screening device for Muslim terrorists cannot be, by definition, have the same effect on non-Muslims. Now, you know, if I stood out, and if I was a member of a group of people, like the Japanese, who had attacked Pearl Harbor, and then everybody else in the country looks at me and says, "Oh my God, he's one of those Japs," I think I could readily understand and see that. If old men with gray hair and beards were blowing up airplanes, and I'm an old man with gray hair and a beard, and I walk into an airport, I could readily understand being taken out of the line and given extra security investigation. I can understand that. The thing I'm having a problem understanding is that none of the people with my characteristics are causing any problems, and the people that are causing all the problems are the ones that are being given a free pass. A free pass. In fact, the Department of Transportation's policy has gotten to the point now where if you see a Muslim in the airport, you don't want to search him. You don't want to sort him out because maybe they'll get us for discrimination. Let me go back here to the last page and listen to this. Domestic intelligence gathering, therefore, will become all the more crucial in the coming year. Unfortunately, most Muslim American organizations, above all the Council on American-Islamic Relations, CAIR, send out a nonstop message of victimology. They're telling Muslims that the United States is their enemy and is stripping them of their civil rights. This summer, CAIR distributed postcards at mosques across the country with the infamous photograph from Abu Ghraib of a hooded prisoner standing on a box with wires hanging from his hands. Juxtaposed with the picture was a 2003 quotation from President Bush saying that the United States was leading the fight against torture. The postcards were supposed to be sent to Congress to demand an end to U.S. government torture. Such propaganda lessens the likelihood that Muslims will volunteer information about possible terror sympathizers in their midst. All the more imperative, then, that no security officer, whether public or private, should fear that if he acts on reasonable suspicion regarding a possible violation of the law or a threat to public safety, his government will accuse him of racism. The skittishness of an airline executive about the possibility of behavioral profiling at American airports should be a thing of the past. Edmund Soladay, he's the former United Airlines Vice President of Safety, lauds Israel's intense scrutiny of passengers. Soladay says he was profiled in Israel. I was a single man alone with no checked baggage in that airport for the first time, wandering aimlessly looking for a payphone. Security hit me. He was intensively questioned, and not just with 7 canned questions pre-approved by the Department of Justice as here. That kind of intervention found 2 suicide bombers in Tel Aviv's airport who were walking on the concourse with identical gym bags but pretending not to know each other. Security sweated them and found explosives in their bags. Why don't we do what the Israelis do? I asked Soladay. Because I'd be in jail in a week, he replied. We can't do that in America. The Transportation Security Administration says that it intends to test behavioral profiling in 2 airports. Whether it will have the fortitude to stand up against the inevitable charges of discrimination remains to be seen. For now, officials trying to protect the public risk, punishment, and opprobrium, while terrorists trying to invade and destroy the country enjoy politically motivated protection, that's a formula for disaster, and it must change. Now, you know, somebody's going to write me an email now and say, well, you dunderhead. What are you proposing, that we just let anybody in and that we not search anybody? I'm not opposed to the security. I'm opposed to the inappropriate security. I'm opposed to the security that singles out people that are obviously not a threat to anybody. One newsletter that came in here, they took an old lady in a wheelchair for crying out loud and took her out and searched her. Now, is that because you thought that this old lady was a Muslim, a Middle Easterner, and that she was going to blow up the airplane? And how about treating people with a little dignity and respect? I mean, if you want to search them, instead of treating them like they're convicts in a penitentiary, getting ready for a shakedown, couldn't you say, sir, our security regime requires that we take you into this private room and that we give you a pat-down search? I wouldn't object to that. Now, what's going on here? This isn't objective any longer. It zeroes in on Americans and leaves out the guys that are causing the problem. That's the thing that I'm complaining about. And if the pilot says, well, look, we got these 5 Arabs over here and they're acting kind of dorky, and so maybe we ought to scrutinize them, I think every Muslim ought to understand and realize that it's your people that are causing the problem. You're the people that we need to search. Now, let's go back over here to Mosul. Are you going to allow into the mess tents Iraqis, just average, run-of-the-mill, average daily Iraqi workers, just walking into the mess tent without searching them from now on? See, it's not the Americans, but I'll tell you what's going to happen. They're going to search the Americans, they're going to search the GIs, they're going to, as well as the Iraqis. And here again, it's not the American servicemen that are causing the problem. It's the Iraqis. That's the guy that you can't tell. He doesn't have on a uniform. You don't know if he's an enemy combatant or not. And he sneaks into your midst. And here's another little story while I'm on the story of the war in Iraq. You know, if we continue on with the kind of news coverage that we've been getting over the past 2 years in Iraq, there's no way in the world that America can win that war, and there's no way in the world that the Iraqi insurgents can lose. And that's because war is 90% psychological, 10% physical. Now, those Iraqi insurgents know that Americans do not have the stomach for war, and that we're ready to cut and run already. And they know that all they have to do is stay in the game, and we'll wear out, we'll give up, quit, and leave like we did in Vietnam. And the reason that Americans are ready to give up and quit and leave is because of the 6 o'clock news. Every newscast I've been watching for the last 90 days, and I've kept track, I haven't seen a single positive report come out of Iraq. Not a single positive report. And I'm not talking about I'm getting my news over Al Jazeera. I'm getting my news from CBS, NBC, and ABC, and every single newscast is pro-Iraqi insurgent and anti-American. Every single newscast is anti-American and pro-Iraqi insurgent. Now, pay attention to what Dan Rather's telling you, and pay attention to what those correspondents are zeroing in on. 3 Americans were killed today. The Iraqi insurgents are getting stronger and stronger, and Americans are getting weaker and weaker. Now, that's the message that you get from Iraq every single day. Now, in World War II, we used to manage the news. When there was bad news from the front, you didn't allow the news media to come on and say, well, the Germans have done it again. Just kick the stuffing out of the Yanks and the British. Look at this battle over here. Certainly Roosevelt and Churchill have their heads up their rectums and don't know how to fight a war. You didn't hear any of that crap coming out of World War II now. And we suffered a lot of defeats. But we suffered a few, and we succeeded in a few victories. And the news that came over was positive. We will stick this out, and by God, we'll stick it to them if this is the last war on planet Earth. We'll fight on the beaches, and we will fight in the streets. Well, Churchill, you know, was quite a leader. Psychologically, the British were psyched up. They believed that they could win. Physically, they didn't have a snowball's chance in hell. But psychologically, they honest to God believed that they could pull the fat out of the fire. But that isn't happening in Iraq. Now, why our government allows that? The only conclusion I can come to is that our government intends to lose the war in Iraq. Just like our government intends that the American dollar be destroyed and that the American economy be destroyed. Probably to meld us into the New World Order. Well, anyway, just tuck that one away in your hearts. Now, the Department of Transportation is not doing anything to help the American economy by stifling people like George Gordon from traveling. The other day, somebody, I'll tell you what it was. I got a videotape in here. Somebody sent to me. It was a good videotape about Canadian trains, the Canadian national train ride from Montreal out to Vancouver. And I said, God, I'd like to take that ride. Now, I think I can get on the Canadian train without any problem, but I don't think I can get from here to Montreal, Canada, without state identification. I really, honest to God, I don't think I can get on a Greyhound bus. The other day, they said if you don't have national identification, you can't get on an Amtrak train. I haven't tested that or checked it out, but that's what I've been hearing. Now, the racial profiling has been carried to such an extreme here as it relates to this war on terrorism that I think that we all ought to be aware of what the bald-faced facts are. Christians and Jews and Buddhists and Shintoists are not terrorists. They're not running around blowing themselves up. The people who are doing that, the people who are these incredible cowards who run around blowing up women and children, are Muslims. 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 Let me repeat that again. Have you got that through your head yet? They're Muslims. Now, 99% of them may be good guys, but it's the 1% that you can't trust. Those are the guys that are causing the problems. Now, why you'd let one of those get on an airplane without searching him and without giving an extra scrutiny is beyond me. And yet, right here in this article, those guys can walk through. They're afraid to search them because it's racial profiling. And I say racial profiling is what we need more of, not less. Yeah, I'm out of time. You've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events, and we do it 7 days a week. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. Well, there's the signal. Says my time's up. I'm going to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.